Welcome to Motivated to Lead podcast, helping you become a better leader. I'm your host, Mark Klingenstein.
Hi, everyone. Thanks again for joining us for our podcast this week. My name is Mark Klingenstein with SEMA Partners. Each week, we interview leaders and they share lessons learned from their careers. Our goal is to help you become a better leader. We've been taking some time to look back at some of our previous conversations with guests over the last few years. And this week, we're going to revisit our conversation with Mike Critelli. Mike was the chairman of the board and CEO of Pitney Bowes, and he led an organization over 33,000 employees with billions of dollars of revenue. He had a very successful career there, and he shares some insights around leadership and what he's learned through his career. Looking forward to today's conversation with Mike.
Great to have Mike joining us this morning. I appreciate you taking some time to talk about leadership and your career.
It's a fun topic to discuss, and there is so much I continue to learn about leadership, as well as what I have learned in the past. So thank you for inviting me.
Absolutely. Well, I guess first off, can you give us just a little bit of your career history and just kind of an overview of some of the things that you've done throughout your career?
I can probably divide my career up into three parts. I began as a practicing attorney, first in private practice, and then 14 years at Pitney Bowes. And toward the tail end of that 19-year period, I took on other executive functions. In addition to being the general counsel, I ran safety and environment and HR. And then the next 15 years, I was a line executive at Pitney Bowes, starting as a group president and moving up to chairman and CEO for the last 12 years of my time. And then the last 13 years, I've been a combination of a serial entrepreneur, philanthropist, and members of various advisory and fiduciary boards.
I like to ask this this question of most guests that we have on. If you were able to spin back time and knowing what you know now, what advice would you give yourself at 22?
Well, I struggled as a practicing attorney, and I had to learn the hard way that much of what you do for people you serve to be a trusted advisor has to do with giving them emotional support and dealing with their seemingly unimportant pain points, but things that really matter to them. In my second law firm, the firm's largest client preferred another guy to me to be the person who was going to make partner, which meant that I had to find another job. The difference was that he spent a lot of time dealing with the firm's family-owned business issues, and I was just doing great legal work. And the issues of how to operate a family business were more important to the client in terms of family relations than how much money we were collecting or how much legal work we were doing. So my boss on the way out said, the client or the customer defines what's valuable. And it's something I wish I had known earlier.
That's great advice. So is there any advice that you received early on in your career that looking back, you should have ignored?
Well, I think that one of the things I learned is that over time, credentials matter less than how well you perform. And I believe that, and it's even more true today, that type A parents, particularly in places like where I lived with our children in Darien, Connecticut, New York City, the big cities, they're so fixated on getting kids into the right schools that they lose track of what's more important, which is, are they teaching them critical thinking skills and resilience and good interpersonal capabilities? So I think we overweight credentials. And I got those credentials, but I learned that they weren't all that useful after the first job out of school.
Talk a little bit, thinking back to kind of that first team that you led within Pitney Bowes and your career. What do you wish you would have known about leadership prior to leading that first team?
Well, my supervisor educated me by the next job he gave me, which was taking on HR, which is that I basically micromanaged my small team because I could. I had a small enough team that I could compensate for their weaknesses. And there were decisions I should have made to move people to different jobs or out of the company earlier, but I was a little blind to that because I could compensate for their weaknesses. When I added human resources to my accountability, the CEO took me in and said, you know, if I gave you a job that was 20% bigger, you would continue managing the same way by increasing your span of control by 400%. You had no choice but to develop people and do a more rigorous evaluation of them.
So when you were in that position, and it's kind of the track that you had within Pitney to becoming the CEO, it is interesting that you had that Chief Human Resource Officer position. What did that teach you, and how did that influence as far as how you led as a CEO?
Well, the number one challenge we had was that we had out of control medical costs. And the team reporting to me was relying on outside experts who told them that we were experiencing 12% annual increases compounded, and maybe we could get down to 10%. And I ended up finding out about outliers through the Dartmouth Atlas survey. And once we focused on what the outlier regions were doing, we realized there was a different approach where we could significantly take cost increases down to virtually flat or very low single digits. And I learned that in any business, statistical evaluation and reporting, averages are very deceptive. They mask a lot of issues, and you have to get to the granular detail and know when and where to look granularly. And that's a lesson. That's one of the lessons I took. The other is, of course, having been responsible for recruiting, I learned about the criticality of great talent and how some leaders at the company were very good at managing talent and others were a little too permissive.
Talk a little bit about just some of the things that you used as far as guidelines as you were hiring, you know, executives within your organization. Talk a little bit about that and some of the things that you paid attention to.
One of the things we paid attention to was cultural fit. Pitney Bowes is a company that is, and at that time was, very egalitarian. So somebody who came in wondering about perks and benefits was probably a non-starter because they would get rejected by the culture. Similarly, we wanted people who had good interpersonal skills and respected the opinions of frontline employees, because there's, we always believed, and I believe today, there's a lot of wisdom in the frontline people that has to be tapped as a leader. And somebody who filters out what the front lines tell him or her is going to miss too much. And the third piece that we had to learn was what were people very good at? Many people inflated their credentials. They said they were general managers. And you found out that they were really glorified sales and service managers, but they had the title of general manager. So we had to dig in and see what was their scope of responsibility and look beyond the titles and the resumes.
I know you were recognized during your tenure as CEO as one of the top 20 companies for leaders. How did you develop that leadership culture within the organization?
I have to credit my HR team and some of my line executives who built the evaluative and development and training tools. I recognized that value. I supported it. I was visible, but I can't say that they took a lot of my intuitive judgments and formalized them. And I was very blessed in having a woman running HR, who's still, by the way, the head of HR at Pitney Bowes, 28 years later, somebody who really knew how to translate intuitive insights into systems and processes and bring in the people who could do that.
So during your tenure at Pitney Bowes, you beat the company beat the S&P index 500 for during your tenure. Yes. What were some of the things that you did as a company? And it's kind of interesting, your story of taking a company that had been around, I think you're at over 100 years now that they've been in existence, but you've took it from a company that wasn't a technology company to a technology company and kind of that transformation. Talk a little bit about that and kind of how you led and were able to help them pivot.
Well, one of the things I brought was a lot of what I would call outside-in thinking. I did not know as much as the people that reported to me. So when I took over the financial services business, I said, why don't we, one of the insights they came up with was, we have very low credit risk in the United States because the credit capacity of our customers is 6 times the average size of our leases and the credit we're granting. I said, well, why don't we extend our offering to lines of credit? And they said, oh, you can't do that because you have to own, you have to be a bank to do that, or you have to work with a bank under the law. And we're not in the banking business. Well, the next year I brought in somebody who had come out of Citibank. And he said, well, you don't need to operate a retail bank. There's a structure called an industrial loan bank. Utah has plenty of franchises. We'll buy one of them. We got into that business. And within 5 years, we had a $200 million business that produced $80 million of operating profit. Wow. The other lesson I learned going back to an experience I had of all places in high school and law school, being on not-for-profit teams, I found that if you can get a little money from a lot of people, you can make very big profit margins if you pick the right offerings. Mm. So at Pitney Bowes, we had a lot of surplus equipment. And we basically said, if we will replace your lost, stolen, damaged, or destroyed equipment within 24 hours if you pay us $10 a month more. And we were able to do that and just tack it on to our leases. It was an incredibly profitable business, but it was based on the principle that $10 a month was a rounding error for our customers. And 65% of them offered that. So I took a lot of life lessons and applied them to business in a way that some of the other people didn't.
I saw an article that was written that you were interviewed, and you talked about transparency. And the quote, I think, was, the beauty of transparency is it eliminates a lot of external pressure. Talk about what that means and kind of some of your philosophy around that in leadership.
Yeah, I actually learned this lesson from my first client where a case went to trial. And the night before the trial, I said to him, Mr. Redmond, are you nervous about testifying? And he said, no, I'm telling the truth, and I'm going to tell the same story every time, so I don't have to think. Mm. And that was a very valuable lesson. The more open you are in telling the truth and nothing but the truth, I'm not sure anybody can ever tell the whole truth, but certainly adhering to the truth and telling nothing but the truth, it makes external communications very simple. It may be painful when you tell people where you've messed up, but it is simple.
So we have a number of listeners that are either new leaders or they've are moving into a new leadership role, new CEO. One of the challenges I think most leaders have if they move into that top spot is to how to work with a board. And I think, you've had a lot of experience, not only as a CEO working with a board, but also serving on a number of boards. I think you were on the board of Eaton Corporation for over, 22 years?
22 and a half years. Yes.
Okay. So you've had some both seats you've sat in, but talk a little bit about how to work with a board and just some of your thoughts around that.
Well, the first lesson I learned about board relations was from the great corporate attorney Marty Lipton, and I met with him at the just before I became chairman of the Pitney Bowes board, and he said, make sure you are meet with each of your board members in person once a year. And when you have a bet your company problem, make sure that you engage fully with them between meetings and spend the extra time, because you don't want to face a life-threatening, organizational threatening issue alone. So that was the first lesson. And surprisingly, many CEOs try to keep their board at an arm's length distance. I never believed that. The second is to expose the board below the CEO and the other people that are going to show up in the boardroom. They'll get a much better feel for the organization if they have skip level meetings. The third piece, which I commend the Eaton CEO, Craig Arnold, for doing, we used to do site visits. All 12 of us would show up at a site. And they were heavily choreographed, and you always felt uncomfortable asking questions because there were so many people, on the board. So he broke up the site visits into three groupings of 3 to 4 people at a time. And it was a much more conversational and intimate approach to learning about what was going on. And one of the other things I'm very pleased about is when we couldn't do the in-person skip level meetings, I suggest that we do Zoom meetings. And in 2020, my last full year on the job, I did 4 Zoom meetings with 4 different people that I would have not been able to see in person. So I'm a strong believer in exposing the board to the intricacies of what's going on in the business.
So, and I'm sure that throughout your career, you've continued to, and you mentioned you love the topic of leadership and continue to grow and develop and in that area. What are some books that you recommend that you would put on a leader's reading list?
One is a book that's come up quite recently. It's called Think Again by Adam Grant. He's a psychologist at the Wharton School. And it's about the need to rethink things. I think one of the mistakes people make is they think they have to be decisive and not change their mind. And leaders need to understand that if something is presented to them that's an anomaly, that's inconsistent with their narrative on the world, they really have to rethink what they think is going on in the world. And unfortunately, that is it isn't done as often as it should be. So that's one of the and related to that, going way back, the book Only the Paranoid Survive by Andy Grove, at that point the CEO of Intel Corporation, this idea that you have to be able to spot strategic inflection points. The third book that I recommend, whether you're getting into the startup world or the big company world or you're on your own, is a book called The Lean Startup by Eric Ries, R-I-E-S. And he said, every encounter with a customer, a partner, a vendor, a government regulator, one of two things should happen, or both. One is you should be successful in accomplishing whatever you set out to do. The other is if you're not successful, you should get validated learning. So the criticality of leadership and learning from every encounter with the outside. Those are three that I would, and going way back, and it's consistent with the Eric Ries philosophy was, and the other three was going way back, Tom Peters' book, Peters and Waterman, which was really all about management by walking around. And he touches that in Search of Excellence, and then again in Thriving on Chaos. But the idea of what can you learn by observation?
So any favorite quotes that you kind of live by or that that you refer back to?
you know, I find myself trying to understand the resistance of people to the facts. And one of my favorite quotes, or there are a couple of quotes going way, way back. One is from Upton Sinclair. And it's something like, it's very hard to convince somebody of something when the continuation of their salary depends on them not understanding it. And there's another quote, and I'm trying to remember, it was either from Upton Sinclair, H.L. Mencken, or Mark Twain. And it was something along the lines of, for every complex problem, there is an answer that's simple, compelling, and wrong. And the final one, which is my lodestar, is Albert Einstein's quote, which is, you need to solve a problem with a different level of thinking than the one that you had when you encountered the problem.
Yeah, those are great, great quotes. Outside of work, what do you do to recharge?
Well, I'm very big on fitness, and I take tennis lessons. I walk every other day. I love rock music and learning about the backstories on it. I love looking at old documentaries. I love the learning that you get from sports. My favorite sport probably is baseball in terms of what you can learn from it as a spectator sport.
Favorite band?
Favorite band? It's a very good question. I don't really have a single favorite band. I like to look at the genesis of bands. Like, for example, one of my daughter gave me the book, The History of the Rolling Stones by Bill Wyman, who is the bass guitarist. And if you were to ask me my favorite musical group, I would probably pick a backup group called The Wrecking Crew that supported Brian Wilson and many other bands. And I liked Brian Wilson in terms of his creativity. And he made a very good documentary record of what he did. But this notion of, you know, how happenstance it was, for example, that the Rolling Stones got together, and how the narrative of how it got together was quite a bit more fragile. The band's future success was a lot more fragile than it appears in hindsight. And I think that's the lesson I learned. It's just like continuation of business success is a lot more fragile than we like to believe it to be.
So you did a project a few years ago, and I found it interesting. You've got the corporate side, you've served on boards, and then you decided to produce a film. Talk a little bit about that and kind of and I think you wrote the screenplay for it. So talk a little bit about that project.
Well, actually, I found the story through a coach for my younger son, who was a white Swedish athlete. He was a chess coach for my son, but he had been a golfer, and he had gone to a historically black college in the United States. And I learned from him that this was the first team, men's college athletic team, coached by a minority woman, a black woman. I bought the life rights 8 years later. I got the film to theaters. I discovered that the only way it was going to get to theaters was if I funded it myself. The screenplay, I was given credit appropriately for what's called story development with another gentleman, but the screenplay was actually written by my son.
Okay.
Whose name happens to be Michael A. Critelli and Michael J. Critelli. And we gave the director-producer, Pierre Bagley, a screenplay credit, which probably was a bit of a stretch, although he did a superb job assembling the cast and crew, and he got the principal photography done on time, under budget. So I commend him for doing that. But then what we learned was getting the movie finalized was like making a third movie. So there's the first movie is the script. The second movie is what you shoot. And the third movie is what you lock into film with music and sound effects. And that was very challenging. I made a couple fundamental judgments. One was we were going to honor what the coach told us she wanted to see in the film about her challenges. And she did, as a Black woman who grew up in the segregated Jim Crow South, she did not want the movie to focus on that or on race relations. She wanted it to focus on the fact that as a woman in a male athletic world, she had a lot of ongoing battles. When the film came to theaters, interestingly enough, some of her athletes and other Black people said the film did not adequately focus on race. And but in her mind, her biggest problem was that male coaches kept her from succeeding, and male department chairs and the male head of diversity programs at the PGA and Brian Gumbel of HBO Real Sports, who attacked her for not just recruiting Black athletes.
Interesting. So the name of that film was From the Rough?
From the Rough. It's metaphorical. Obviously, the reference to The Rough came from an interview with the great Spanish golfer, Seve Ballesteros. And by the way, there's a leadership lesson in here. He basically said, I learned, in effect, what he was saying is, I learned how to play golf backwards. I learned how to hit the most difficult shots first. And then I got lessons on how to hit drives and iron shots from the fairway. But if you can get out of trouble, and he wrote a book called Troubleshooting, you're a lot more resilient and self-confident. You don't have to hit the perfect drive or the perfect fairway iron. The second parallel meaning to this is, if you come up from very difficult circumstances in life and you succeed despite them, you're a lot more self-confident in life for any number of reasons. And it's true of any field. I remember the great Hall of Fame pitcher for the Braves, Warren Spahn, who had during World War II, he had been part of the army and was going on the beach at Normandy. And then they asked him later, do you feel stressed out pitching in the World Series? And he said, it's a lot easier than going up the beach in Normandy. Sure. Absolutely. So the toughness you develop is something that's very important in later life. And that was the lesson we got through the movie. It's got a 4.6 out of 5 rating on Amazon Prime, which is the easiest place to find it today. We're going to be on the Brigham Young University TV network starting in a week. Mm-hmm. And we're going to be on Bounce TV January 1. That's the digital network that's appealing to a Black audience.
Okay, great. Well, I'm looking forward to seeing that that film. And what parting advice would you give a new or up and coming leader?
Well, to use a baseball metaphor, it's not your batting average that counts. It's how many runs do you produce and how many wins do you contribute to, even with a low batting average? So do not be afraid to make mistakes or change careers. And don't be intimidated by people who seem to be the experts. One of the gifts I received as a trial attorney, which was what I did at the start of my career, and it was in the rough and tumble of Chicago courtrooms, is I would do all this work and prepare a written brief. And then I get into a court and the judge would have a stack of 50 written briefs as he was going to get through 50 cases. And he'd point a very menacing finger at me and the opposing attorney, say, "What's this case about?" And I had to learn how to do elevator speeches in a very high-stressed environment. I wasn't very good at it in the beginning, but year after year, having to do that was a great lesson. And so you get the earlier and the more intensively you get tested, the more you learn, the faster you get to reaching your potential, and which is why I recommend the Eric Ries book about validated learning. So I tell people, do not be afraid to make mistakes, to admit to mistakes, and to admit that you don't have all the answers.
Well, this has been a lot of fun, and appreciate you again taking some time out to talk to us. I know this is going to be helpful for our audience, and I'm going to go back and listen to it again because you've got a wealth of information to share. And again, I wish you continued success in all you do.
Well, thank you very much. I'm honored to have been on this program.
Thank you for listening to the Motivated to Lead podcast. Please subscribe on iTunes. You can also see a video version of this interview at motivatedtolead.com. This podcast is brought to you by SEMA Partners, helping you find your next great leader.